former British ambassador to Bahrain, Mr. Peter Ford, joining us from Manchester. Also, thanks to Masoud Shajareh from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, joining us from London. Also, special thanks to you all for staying with us on this debate. It's a good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف
name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time, and Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
France extends coronavirus lockdowns in its northern region as Austria and Sweden witness protests against COVID-19 restrictions. Also ahead, nationwide protests against the recent military coup in Myanmar escalate despite a deadly crackdown. Welcome to the program. Our top story, the U.S. Senate has passed a major rescue plan put forward by the administration to help revive the country's economy during the coronavirus pandemic.
The yeas are 50, the nays are 49. The bill as amended is passed.
Party line vote saw no Republicans voting for the $1.9 trillion package. A sweeping legislation now heads back to the House of Representatives. The Democratic majority chamber is expected to adopt a relief package, making it one of the largest stimulus plans in U.S. history. President Biden hailed the approval as a giant step toward reviving America's pandemic-stricken economy. Take a listen.
When we took office 45 days ago, I promised the American people that help was on the way. Today, I can say we've taken one more giant step forward in delivering on that promise that help is on the way. This plan puts us on a path to beating the virus. This plan gives those families who are struggling the most the help and the breathing room they need to get through this moment. This plan gives small businesses in this country a fighting chance to survive.
Legislation would send out $1,400 stimulus checks to most Americans. It allocates $350 billion to state and local governments. The bill also provides $49 billion for COVID testing and $14 billion for vaccine distribution. The coronavirus pandemic has left more than 500,000 people dead out of 29 million cases in the U.S. About an hour ago, I spoke to Professor of Economics Steve Keen, who believes more should have been done to help Americans through the pandemic.
It's certainly good that it's been done. More should have been done because the real impact of COVID on the average working American is that their cash flow has dried up, but their financial commitments still remain. So if you look at what that's meant to households in America, everybody's focusing on a so-called increase in the savings rate. That is actually just an artifact of the definition of savings as output minus consumption, where consumption has fallen more than output. But the actual level of household debt in America has risen by about 4 or 5% of GDP. So households are borrowing money just simply to keep on paying their bills. And this will go some way towards addressing that, but not the full distance.
Paraguay's President Mario Abdo Benitez has announced a cabinet reshuffle amid unrest over his government's COVID response.
As president, my job is to serve our people. I'm aware that people are hoping for change, and I'm going to make them. That is why I have informed the entire cabinet that they will be relieved of their posts in the coming hours. Decrees for new appointments will be published.
Benitez called for greater participation and dialogue to correct mistakes. He also condemned acts of violence. Paraguay's president has faced calls to step down over his response to the pandemic. People hit the streets of the capital, Asunción, on Friday, blaming him for deteriorating the situation. Security forces fired rubber bullets and tear gas to break up the rally. Several were injured as a result. Paraguay's COVID crisis has already forced the resignation of the health minister. The country has so far reported nearly 166,000 COVID cases and more than 3,200 deaths. The vaccination program has been hampered by delays in the arrival of jabs. Brazil imposes new COVID-19 restrictions in its most populous cities as the country suffers a new surge of the pandemic. In São Paulo, a new lockdown is in place while officials in Rio de Janeiro introduced new restrictions, including a nighttime curfew. Several businesses in Rio have been ordered to either close early or shut down altogether. This comes as coronavirus deaths in Brazil are nearing 263,000 out of some 10.9 million confirmed cases. The figure is the world's second highest death toll from the pandemic. Meanwhile, the U.S. remains the world's worst hit, with 29 million confirmed infection cases and more than 524,000 deaths. Remaining with the issue, in France, though, the country has extended weekend lockdowns to its northern parts as it is struggling to contain its coronavirus outbreak. The measure now puts more than 2 million people across France under the weekend restrictions. The pandemic has killed 88,300 people across France, one of the highest death tolls in Europe. In some countries, COVID restrictions brought people to the streets. In Austria's capital, protesters demanded the resignation of Chancellor Kurz. Many of them did not wear masks or observe social distancing. In Sweden, people rallied in the capital in defiance of a government ban that is on large gatherings. Six people, or police officers, I should be saying, were injured in scuffles with the protesters. China says its exports recorded their fastest annual growth in over two decades during the January-February period. China's customs data show exports jumped by over 60% in the first 2 months of the year compared to a year earlier. The surge is fueled by a rebound in foreign demand. That comes as manufacturing gets back on its feet in major economies, including the U.S. and the EU. Economic activity in China was battered by the coronavirus pandemic early in 2020. That led outbound trade to nosedive by 17%. China has largely weathered the pandemic ever since. Remaining in East Asia, anti-coup demonstrators have once again hit the streets across Myanmar to demand civilian rule. The largest rally took place in the second city of Mandalay. Protests in half a dozen cities were peaceful, but in some locations, police reportedly used tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the protesters. Locals in the largest city, Yangon, also said soldiers stormed several districts and made arrests. The latest rallies took place despite a military crackdown that the UN says has so far killed at least 50 people. Myanmar's army seized power on February the 1st and detained civilian officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Protests have been ongoing ever since. The Iranian president has urged Iraqi officials to speed up the enforcement of a parliamentary ratification mandating the expulsion of U.S. forces from the Arab country. In a phone call with the Iraqi Prime Minister, President Hassan Rouhani of Iran said the move will help establish peace and security across the region, including Iraq. He emphasized that America has always played a destructive role in the region. Iranian president also expressed opposition to foreign meddling in Iraqi affairs, which he regards as detrimental not only to Iraq but to the entire region. He stressed Iraq's integrity and security remain a priority for Iran. In response, Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi thanked Iran for helping establish peace and stability in Iraq. He also underlined the need to expand all-out bilateral ties. Political commentator Michael Springman says the U.S. has invaded West Asia and refuses to go home.
Well, it's there because it wants to control the region. It wants to enforce its influence, not only in Iraq, but in other countries there. The Persian Gulf countries like the Gulf Cooperation Council, Saudi Arabia, and so forth. And it's there to threaten Iran. It's watching Iran from its bases in Iraq. And, of course, the American government thinks they have a right to be there. And they claim that they're there to enforce order and restore peace and security. And if they left, everything would turn into chaos. Well, it's chaos now simply because the Americans invaded and occupied and flatly refused to go home. I could see them making a show of removing a couple of hundred soldiers or a particular unit or something like this, but they're not going to say, okay, we're going to take every last American soldier and mercenary, which everyone seems to forget. They're basically former soldiers who act as soldiers but without uniforms.
Welcome to this hour's On the News Line. Israel is facing an ICC probe into war crimes committed in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Investigation includes Palestinian deaths in the 2014 war on Gaza and March of Return rallies, as well as Israel's illegal settlements. Tel Aviv's closest ally, Washington, has expressed opposition to the probe, saying the Hague-based court does not have jurisdiction over the matter.
The United States remains on a collision course with the International Criminal Court, even after the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump yielded power to the Joe Biden administration, which was expected to be softer on issues related to international organizations. The reasons for the troubled relations have remained unchanged: the ICC's decision to probe war crimes committed by the United States and Israel. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who has been probing war crimes committed by Israel, the U.S., and their allies, said in December 2019 that such crimes have been or were committed in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She named the Israeli military, which has for years unleashed a reign of terror on Palestinians, as the perpetrator of war crimes. The ICC prosecutor further noted that there was a reasonable basis to launch a probe into Israeli military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. Bensouda then asked judges to rule on the extent of the court's jurisdiction in the case, and the court last month established that it had jurisdiction. The announcement was not received well by Washington and Tel Aviv. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that the U.S. opposes any such probe, as the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. The phone call followed U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's statement that Washington firmly opposes and is deeply disappointed by the decision.
And if the state is very certain and very secure that the Israeli regime and these occupiers have not committed war crimes, so why not give a chance to the investigators, the bipartisan group that will be coming in, that is not biased, and they will be investigating all the cases that they have in their files, in their system, and to prove that they're innocent, right? And then at that point, we don't have this continuous problem coming up and arising again.
The U.S. and Israel have repeatedly shown their opposition to being held accountable for their actions over the years.
Well, as I was telling you before this, we were on that ONL story that had to do with the ICC's opening up a formal investigation into war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. Well, is a welcome move, but will it actually translate into action on the ground? For example, the ICC also opened up an investigation, if you remember, into American troops' war crimes in Afghanistan. The U.S., however, blocked the inquiry, putting the investigation on hold. Well, the ICC jurisdiction plays an important role here. It does not, or actually does, need the cooperation of the authorities to be able to investigate the crimes. Yet, in the case of Israel, how can this even make a difference? After all, Israel commits crimes and violates international law in the occupied Palestinian territories almost on a daily basis. Here's a report.
The ICC, which has often sought to expose war crimes committed by the Israeli regime and the U.S. around the world, has faced bullying and intimidation from both Tel Aviv and Washington. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on the Hague-based tribunal staff last year, targeting them with asset freezes and travel bans, accusing them of violating the U.S. national sovereignty by launching a probe into war crimes committed by the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Biden administration took no immediate action to reverse the move, despite promising to put overruling Trump's damaging measures on top of his agenda. The new U.S. administration did announce it would rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council, which its predecessor withdrew from 2018, citing an anti-Israeli bias, but it said upon re-engaging with the U.N. body, it will press to eliminate a disproportionate focus on its Israeli ally.
I mean, this shows essentially from the beginning that they're not going there really for human rights. They're going there to secure and support Israel and to bury their war crimes and to get people away from holding the Israeli regime accountable. I mean, why is there all these resolutions in the first place against Israel? Obviously because there's continuous developments, there's continuous war crimes, there's continuous bombardments, there's continuous blockades, there's continuous crimes.
We will be back. And I'm a man of my word. America is back. I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back.
Joe Biden has repeated this sentence multiple times since becoming president, taking a veiled sideswipe at his predecessor's isolation foreign policy and promising a return to multilateralism in a bid to win over the estranged U.S. allies and revive the frosty transatlantic relations. While Washington's European partners have largely expressed support for his administration, divisions between them still persist. In the latest example, an EU spokesperson said, "The bloc supports the ICC as an independent and impartial judicial institution with no political objectives to pursue." Peter Stano was responding to a request for comment on Netanyahu's recent diatribe against the court, who had blasted the war crime probe as, quote, "the essence of anti-Semitism." President Biden says he will bring back what he calls America's moral leadership in the world. The question is, how can the U.S. advocate such leadership while it continues to penalize those who work to expose crimes instead of the true culprits?
Iran's international Quran competition is a major Quranic event, which is held every year in Iran before the holy month of Ramadan. This year, however, the Quranic event is held online due to the coronavirus pandemic. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Voices of Divinity. These ear-soothing voices narrate divine verses from the holy book of Quran. The recitations come as part of the 37th International Quran Competition, based in Iran. 57 finalists from 26 countries are competing in the annual contest, which was held online this year due to the pandemic.
This year, the contestants sent us recordings of their recitations. Those recitations then are broadcast live on the IRIB Quran channel, and the judgment is carried out by our selected jury members at the same time. This is a brand new style in holding the competition. All other similar Quranic events are canceled as a result of the pandemic.
411 participants from 67 countries took part in the primary stage of the competition. 122 contestants made it to the semi-final stage. Participants compete in three different fields of recitation: memorization and interpretation.
Listening to the verses of the Quran through the beautiful voice of Quran reciters gives you better peace and spirituality. Such recitations permeate the depths of your heart and connect you to God. That is why the tradition of recitation is still extant today and has many followers.
There is a verse in the Holy Quran that says, "Verily, in the remembrance of God do hearts find rest." And the reading or reciting the divine verses of the Holy Book truly makes you remember your Creator and help you find peace.
The Endowment and Charity Affairs Organization, which organizes the Quranic event, says the motto of this year's edition is One Book, One Ummah. It says the ultimate goal of the event is to unite the Muslim community based on the teachings of the Holy Book of Quran.
Not all Muslims can recite the Holy Book of Quran as perfectly as contestants here do. But every Muslim family has the Holy Book in their houses to read it and ponder the messages embedded in its verses. Messages that Muslims here say boil down to this key instruction: follow the path of righteousness. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
The United States has been at war for nearly every year of its existence as an independent nation, fighting in 227 years of its 244-year history. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Alan McLeod Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. and Allies drop 46 bombs per day for 20 years. New Code Pink research reveals. Here's the details. The United States and its allies have dropped at least 326,000 bombs and missiles on countries in the West Asia-North Africa region since 2001. That is the conclusion of new research by Milia Benjamin and Nicholas J. S. Davis of anti-war group Code Pink. Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Yemen are the countries that have felt the worst of the violence. But Lebanon, Libya, Pakistan, Palestine, and Somalia have also been targeted. The total amounts to an average of 46 bombs dropped per day over the last 20 years. Code Pink's numbers are based primarily on official U.S. military releases as well as data from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, the Yemen Data Project, and the New America Foundation. As striking as the figure of 326,000 is, it is an underestimate, as the Trump administration ceased publishing figures of its bombing campaigns in 2020, meaning there is no data for Iraq, Syria, or Afghanistan for either of the previous 2 years. Also not counted are bombs or missiles used in helicopter strikes, AC-130 gunships attacks, strafe-finding guns from U.S. bombers, or any other counterinsurgency or counterterrorism operations in other parts of the world. U.S. President Joe Biden recently gave the order to attack Iraq anti-terror forces in Syria, dropping 1.75 tons of bombs on a border village and killing 22 people, something that brought cheers from Washington insiders and corporate media pundits alike. The move was reportedly in response to strikes on U.S. military bases in Iraq, bases that last year the Iraqi parliament unanimously demanded be closed. Recently, anonymous administration officials claimed that Biden called off a second serious strike after being warned that women and children were in the area. Though no evidence was offered and the officials refused to go on record, corporate media diligently parroted the State Department line, allowing the new administration to simultaneously present itself as getting tough on its enemies and as a champion of human rights. The United States has been at war for nearly every year of its existence as an independent nation, fighting in 227 years of its 244-year history. While both Barack Obama and Donald Trump offered up anti-war rhetoric,
When they were on the campaign trail, both moved steadfastly away from that position once in office. By 2016, Obama was bombing seven countries simultaneously and had earned the moniker Drone King. Trump, meanwhile, escalated the war in Yemen and even carried out the targeted assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani while he was in Iraq for regional peace talks. The 45th president also authorized the use of mother of all bombs, a 21,000 pound, that is about 9,500 kilogram explosive dropped on Afghanistan's Nangarhar province in April 2017. Many of the Biden administration's early moves signal that there will be more continuation of than rupture with previous U.S. foreign policy in the West Asia region. While Biden had pledged to end U.S. role in Yemen, the U.S. State Department qualifying language makes it clear that the U.S. is merely returning to Obama's position on the conflict. Biden promised only to end support for offensive Saudi campaigns and limit relevant arms sales. Yet his administration immediately began emphasizing its commitment to help Riyadh defend itself from aggression. The U.S. envoy Timothy Leatherking even went so far to praise the Saudi Arabia regime for its generous support over the decades for the people of Yemen. On the Zionist regime, Biden has fully supported Trump's decision to move the American embassy to Al-Quds, a controversial move effectively approving the Zionist regime occupation of Palestine. Today, Vice President Kamala Harris had a meeting with the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in which she reaffirmed the White House's unwavering commitment to the Zionist regime and its security. Meanwhile, Biden has framed Syria attack as a message to Iran. Despite its spending almost as much as every other country combined on defense, the impact of war is largely unfelt in the United States. As media Benjamin and Davis write, the American public and the world are left almost completely in the dark about the death and destruction our country's leaders keep wreaking in our name. With studies such as this one, Code Pink hopes to change that fact.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Joe Biden's first military action as president of the United States was to bomb Syria, cementing himself as another warmonger in the Oval Office. The claim that these strikes were defensive in nature is an absurdity coming from an occupying force, which most seem to gloss over. This was a violation of Syria's sovereignty and territory and another act of imperialist aggression. So let's break this down. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On February 25th, 2021, the United States bombed the Syrian Arab Republic. The airstrikes took place on the border between Iraq and Syria, around Abu Kamal, located in the Deir ez-Zor province in eastern Syria. According to the Syrian Arab News Agency, four were wounded and one person was martyred. Shortly after the attack, the Pentagon released a statement saying, quote, at President Biden's direction, U.S. military forces earlier this evening conducted airstrikes against infrastructure utilized by Iranian-backed militant groups in eastern Syria. These strikes were authorized in response to recent attacks against American and coalition personnel in Iraq and to ongoing threats to those personnel. Specifically, the strikes destroyed multiple facilities located at a border control point used by a number of Iranian-backed militant groups, unquote. So this statement claims that these strikes were defensive, which is an absurdity in of itself. Syria has not bombed the United States or declared war on the United States. Syria is on the other side of the planet. The United States has no business being in Syria. Moreover, the claim that they were meant for de-escalation simply does not compute. Bombing another country is tantamount to a declaration of war, not de-escalation. China, Venezuela, Iran all condemned the attack, and Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, strongly condemned the bombing and called for unconditional respect for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Syria, which should not be used to settle geopolitical scores. So according to the Biden administration, this attack on Syria was a response by the United States to recent attacks on its personnel. Now, it's widely assumed by the media that what they're referring to is a rocket attack that took place on February 15th in Erbil in Iraq, where an American contractor was killed. Six others were wounded, including an American soldier. And in another instance on February 22nd, when a rocket landed inside the Green Zone in Baghdad. This is where the U.S. Embassy is located, the biggest embassy in the world, almost the size of Vatican City, which looks more like a military installation than anything else. So while the United States claims it's defending itself and responding to rocket attacks, it conveniently leaves out the obvious that the United States is in Iraq illegally. It illegally invaded Iraq in 2003, along with Britain. The U.S.-led coalition has no right to be in Iraq in the first place, nor in Syria for that matter. So you can't talk about defending yourself when you are the aggressor, when you are the oppressor, when you are illegally on someone else's land. You're not defending yourself when you're on someone else's land, you are attacking. Moreover, the United States has imposed crippling sanctions on Iran, which are indeed a form of siege warfare. It assassinated General Soleimani. It has violated Iran's sovereignty numerous times. But the U.S. is not officially at war with Iran, so why is it bombing Iranian-backed militias? Is that supposed to make it okay? When the U.S. talks of Iranian-backed militias, what they really mean are the Popular Mobilization Forces, the PMU, or in Arabic, the Hashd al-Sha'bi. These are not Iranian troops. They're a popular resistance movement made up of various local ethnic religious groups, which include Shia, Sunni, Christians, Druze, who have fought very hard to defeat Daesh and to resist occupation. But of course, the United States can't speak of them as a popular resistance because then people would rightfully wonder, what are they resisting? And this would expose the United States and their allies as illegal occupiers, as an invading force, which has no right to be there in the first place. As long as a Pentagon official or a stenographer for the White House says Iran or Iranian-backed militias, that's all it takes for everyone's brains to suddenly shut down and just accept that Joe Biden is bombing another sovereign nation. First of all, whether Iran has troops or militias, as they say in Syria, or the other way around, this is a matter between Iran and Syria. The United States has no right to interfere in the eternal politics, alliances, partnerships, and cooperations between those two countries. Would the United States accept it if, for example, Syria bombed Korea for having an American base there? Of course not. So this is not a valid argument. Syria is a sovereign nation, Iran is a sovereign nation, Iraq is a sovereign nation. But of course, this is of no concern to the Americans and British who have colonized the region for centuries, plundering and stealing resources and meddling in the region's political affairs. Donald Trump assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Quds force, along with Abu Mahdi, a senior commander of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, the PMU. Now, Joe Biden bombs the PMU inside Syria. Both these actions only serve to help Daesh. And this wouldn't be the first time, of course, that the United States and its military actions, whether purposely or not, end up helping Daesh seeking to take over Syria and Iraq. In 2016, U.S. warplanes killed 62 Syrian troops in an airstrike and wounded more than 100. These troops were directly involved in the fight against Daesh. Again, in 2018, the U.S. bombed Syrian and Russian troops inside Syria, which only serves to help the foreign-backed terrorists, which they were fighting in the first place. But on top of that, they're not only benefiting Daesh with these actions, Israel is at the very least very sure to be happy about Biden's decision to bomb Syria. After all, for years, Israel has been routinely bombing Syria almost on a weekly basis, taking advantage of the fact that Syria is crippled by war and sanctions. And usually Israel almost never admits to the illegal assassinations or bombings that it carries out on other nations and governments. But Israeli officials have previously confirmed that they have carried out hundreds, if not over 1,000 airstrikes on Syria in the last decade alone. And seeing how close Israel and the United States are in their shared interests, it's not surprising, of course, that Joe Biden uses the exact same pretext. Joining me now to talk more about Biden's airstrikes on Syria is Max Abrams, Associate Professor of Political Science at Northeastern University and Fellow at the Quincy Institute. Thanks for taking the time, Professor. I appreciate having you on.
Happy to be on your show.
So, Professor, in 2018, Donald Trump bombed Syria over the alleged chemical gas attacks in Douma. Now, the OPCW scandal, that's an entire story in of itself, but I want to focus on the contrast in reaction here. At the time, Democrats like AOC and Kamala Harris rebuked Trump, citing the illegality of the strikes, yet now they're mostly silent on Biden. So there's a bit of a double standard going on here in the reaction from the media and Democrats. Would you agree with that assessment?
I see what you're saying, and I could definitely go that route. I have seen what you're describing, which is apparent hypocrisy by Kamala Harris talking about illegality, Syrian sovereignty, and now she's the vice president, and there's doesn't seem to be any respect for Syrian sovereignty. That said, I see more continuity than differences, because although Trump, was very reviled in the American public, especially in the media, one of the very few things he ever did in his whole life that was celebrated in the aggregate was attacking Syria. You'll remember that Fareed Zakaria said after he authorized the strike, congratulations, Donald Trump, it's like your first day as president. You've finally become a real president. And so if you want to be popular, regardless of whether you're on the American political left or right, with the exception of the fringes, but sort of mainstream left, mainstream right, yeah, attack Iran, attack Syria, people will quibble, but in general, there is political value for that decision making.
Speaking of continuity, Donald Trump assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force, and Abu Mahdi, senior commander in the PMU, which were hit just now in the airstrike by Biden. Would you say there's continuity in that and their general policy towards Iran? And who stands to benefit the most here exactly? Because, whether the United States calls them Iranian-backed militias or not, the PMU have still contributed enormously in the fight against Daesh, against ISIS. So who's benefiting the most from what just took place exactly?
You're quite right that when Trump authorized the killing of Soleimani, that was depicted as controversial in the United States, and he was criticized by Democrats, whereas clearly under Biden, we are seeing a continuity of targeted killing, and so there is hypocrisy there. With respect to who benefits, I think that one of the beneficiaries is Israel. I think that Israel, its greatest threat, according to Israeli officials, is this, it's described as a land bridge from Tehran to Beirut, particularly this axis, the Iranian government and the Iranian militia groups all the way into the Levant. So I think that Israel recognizes that the Biden administration is not as categorically, reflexively pro-Israel as the Biden administration was. Now, don't get me wrong. I still expect the Biden administration to be very pro-Israel, but not to the same degree as Trump was. You know, they name towns and things after Trump. I'm not sure they're going to do that with Biden. So a lot of people, the conventional wisdom in the American media was that Biden was sending a signal to Iran. I actually think that the signal was to Israel more, saying we're not going to tolerate this kind of land bridge. And even though there was this delay from Biden contacting Netanyahu, don't worry, the Biden administration is going to look out for Israel just as Trump did. I think that probably the attack doesn't really surprise Iran all that much and probably doesn't fundamentally affect U.S.-Iranian relations. I think that it's not a significant – in the history books, this will not be registered as an event in terms of that important bilateral relationship. I do think that the media has done a very bad job, an intentionally bad job, in describing the relationship between Iran and ISIS. The American media likes to downplay the fact that Iran has been not only at odds with ISIS, but one of ISIS's primary enemies, especially on the ground. And that was true both in Iraq as well as in Syria. There's an inverse relationship between them and ISIS. And so there is a concern that if Iran were continued to be attrited, as well as Russia, which has also been deeply maligned, of course, in the American media in all sorts of ways, but especially with respect to its relationship to Salafi jihadists, that could create the kind of space for ISIS and al-Qaeda and affiliated jihadists to grow.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, one thing I'm not seeing talked a lot about in the media is how this is going to affect the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. What do you think will happen there, specifically when the Biden administration says they're open to more talks with European partners, although Iran says it wants sanctions lifted first? Do you think these strikes are going to affect the Iran nuclear deal and diplomatic endeavors in any way?
As you and your guests very well know, under Biden, the Obama administration really helped to broker the Iran nuclear deal. And so when Trump effectively destroyed it, and then Biden would get elected, one would think that, particularly because the nuclear deal was cast as Obama and Biden's one of their biggest, most important foreign policy legacies, you would expect them to just continue forward and to do whatever it takes to jumpstart this deal, which they were highly critical of Trump for derailing. But they haven't done that, actually. You know, they've added all these additional hoops. Who's going to go first? You know, is there going to be relief? You know, is the nuclear deal going to be fundamentally changed? Are they going to add provisions to it? Are they going to include more features, like with respect to rockets and support for militant groups? All of this kind of talk increases the odds that the nuclear deal will not be recommenced. And so it is a little bit surprising how tepid they are in pushing this negotiation forward. So there seems to be a lack of clarity and a lack of bravery from this administration. And I think that we see that in the Iran nuclear deal.
How about Democrats actually doing anything to limit the scope of the AUMF? Do you see anything happening there? You know, supposedly since they control the House and the Senate barely. I kind of already know the answer, but go ahead.
It'll be interesting to see how much this administration can moderate sort of its inclination, which is to get increasingly involved in the region at a time when the American public is turning away. I think that the administration is simply going to reframe and recast some of the same behaviors, but in different terms. So we see a continuation of the use of American military force and intervention, but there's a real emphasis by the Biden team to say that it's defensive in nature. We've seen this with the weapons going to Yemen. They are defensive. You know, we see the U.S. Attacking supposedly Iranian targets on the Syrian border, and it's defensive. So I think that there's a real sort of PR effort to present the United States as good guys, even if the U.S. will continue to liberally use military force, including probably to promote its freedom agenda, which it knows has taken on a negative connotation. And so perhaps that won't be as much of an emphasis as, for example, under the George W. Bush administration, when neoconservatives would just exclaim very loudly that our goal is to promote democracy throughout the region.
Max Abrams, thanks so much for your valuable insight. It's really a pleasure speaking with you and having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to come on anytime.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
At the end of the day, we really get to see once again how Biden and his policies are just a continuation of the same old. As a matter of fact, they're almost indistinguishable from those of his predecessor, Donald Trump. Donald Trump puts sanctions on Syria, Biden keeps them. Donald Trump steals Syria's oil, Biden also steals Syria's oil. Trump builds illegal bases in Syria, Biden keeps them and builds more illegal bases in Syria. Trump bombs Syria in 2018, Biden also bombs Syria in 2021. That's not the lesser of two evils, that's precisely the same evil continued. When Trump imposed the Caesar Act sanctions on Syria in June 2020, we all knew that civilians would be hurt the most, that people would starve in a country already ravaged by a decade of war. Joe Biden, who people call the lesser of two evils, was he going to reverse this? Of course not. Secretary of State Blinken, who's his foreign policy advisor at the time during the campaign, told the Washington Post that Biden thought the sanctions were a very important tool. These sanctions have crushed the lira, the Syrian pound. Syrians are forming bread lines in a country that once used to be self-sufficient and a net exporter of wheat. Within days of Biden taking office, we saw a convoy of U.S. trucks illegally cross over from Iraq into Syria through the El Walid border crossing, as they always do, on their way to steal more oil. The Syrian permanent representative to the United Nations, Bashar al-Jafari, warned Joe Biden, quote, "The new U.S. administration must stop acts of aggression and occupation, plundering the wealth of my country, withdraw its occupying forces from it, and stop supporting separatist militias, illegal entities, and attempts to threaten Syria's sovereignty, unity, and territorial integrity." Of course, Joe Biden has done no such thing. And despite a statement by the Pentagon that their priority isn't the oil, Biden still has U.S. troops building bases in Syria illegally, occupying Syria's oil fields illegally. And just like Trump bombed Syria, now we see Biden bombing Syria, although not over chemical weapons, but another one of the media's favorite boogeymen, the so-called Iranian-backed militias. You know, at least in 2018, Kamala Harris, who's now the vice president, rebuked Trump, saying she's deeply concerned about the legal rationale of the strikes. Really? She's concerned about the legal rationale of such strikes? That's wonderful. I really hope she maintains that same attitude towards Joe Biden, although I highly doubt she will. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called Trump a mad king who decided to, quote, bomb a nation without the constitutional requirement of congressional approval. And yet, unlike 2018, suspiciously, AOC is nowhere to be found right now. She's been completely silent on Joe Biden's airstrikes on Syria. With the exception of Ilhan Omar, she correctly pointed out how outrageous the AUMF is because of the sweeping powers that it gives the president. Fundamentally, you know, we still don't see any mention of actual consequences? Where's the plan to get rid of the AUMF? Where are the consequences for Joe Biden's actions in violating his oath of office and bombing a sovereign nation? We're not hearing any of it. They're all quiet. You know, I'm sure the American people are so happy to see that one of Joe Biden's first accomplishments in office has been to bomb Syria. Americans, the very same Americans who have yet to see any of those relief checks they were promised, which were originally $2,000, now reduced to $1,400. The same Americans who were told they can't have a minimum wage, a $15 minimum wage through budget reconciliation, even though Biden said it would be a top priority and made it one of the pillars of his campaign. The same Americans who were told no more kids in cages, which also turned out to be a lie. The kids are no longer separated from their parents, perhaps, but they're still locked up in nicer looking cages with air conditioners. The same Americans that were told the erratic Donald Trump would be defeated and replaced with Biden, who would restore the soul of the nation and dignity to the White House. It seems Americans were told a lot of things, a lot of nice things. And not just by Biden's campaign, but even by intellectuals and scholars that claimed he would be less dangerous than Trump. Well, as far as Syria is concerned, that's nonsense. But it's okay, though, because remember, at least now there's diversity. Remember, you were promised diversity and unity by the Biden administration? So now you have Lloyd Austin, the first black man to lead the Pentagon, who also happens to be a former board member for Raytheon, the weapons manufacturer. Or the fact that Kamala Harris is the first Asian-American and female vice president. Or Avril Haines, the first woman to be director of national intelligence. Now that makes everything okay. Just put a bunch of rainbows on the bombs and everything will be okay, right? Of course, the neocons and proponents of the war on terror will tell you that Biden does have the right to do military strikes on other nations under the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, the AUMF, which was signed into law in 2001, 2002, giving a carte blanche, a blank check for the Bush administration and every administration since to invade other countries, order drone strikes and assassinations, and run wild with any foreign policy decision they please. Many have rightfully criticized the AUMF and have called it constitutional for the sweeping powers that it gives the commander-in-chief, who can effectively bypass Congress and go behind its back to attack other countries. But even if the entire U.S. Congress had okayed this imperialist attack on Syria, that would still not make it okay. The U.S. Congress is not the world police. Its decrees are not universal and absolute. Biden's airstrikes on Syria are first and foremost a violation of international law. The United States has no right to attack a sovereign nation and another member of the United Nations. This clearly violates the United Nations Charter, specifically Article 2.4, which says that all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. But of course, it's not about laws, it's about language, it's about PR. So under Trump, the kids in cages, that's called concentration camps. But under Biden, they're migrant overflow facilities. And when Trump bombs Syria, they decry him as a mad king, but when Biden does, they're defensive airstrikes. You know, let's just go ahead and remove the word imperialism from the dictionary. Let's replace it with Biden's unity slogan instead, shall we? So while Biden's administration claims it's more diverse, let's be frank with each other here. There's no diversity in terms of policy. You know, he can paint as many transgender flags and put as many Black Lives Matter decals on the bombs as he wants, but these are the same imperialist tactics, the same imperialist agenda used by every president before him. This is just a furthering of America's imperialist interests and its neocon behavior, which the U.S. has been carrying out in the Middle East for the past decades, crippling Syria, crippling Syria's allies, being hawks on Iran, continuing to occupy Iraq illegally. That's what it comes down to, and there's no difference there. So to claim diversity, this means absolutely nothing for the people who are under those bombs when they fall. As a matter of fact, it means nothing for Americans who are also being given the short end of the stick and robbed of their own wealth so that the military-industrial complex, the weapons manufacturers, and private corporations can make tons of money and build swimming pools for themselves while they starve. That's what it comes down to. There's no diversity there. But in moments like these, I think it's very important to look back at history, right? Damascus, the capital of Syria, where I was born, is the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. It's thousands of years old. Many civilizations, many empires have tried to capture Syria. Many foreign invaders and their armies have tried to take the Middle East and claim Syria as their own. But none of them last forever. Look around Syria and you will find nothing but the ruins of those very empires who thought they would last forever. As history shows us, every dog has their day. Every empire rises and every empire falls. But Syria always remains. Inshallah. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is the communique.
In the limelight.
The Michigan Congresswoman said the ICC has the authority and duty to independently and impartially investigate and deliver justice to victims of human rights violations and war crimes in Palestine, says Brett Wilkins, writer in an article published under the heading "No One is Above the Law." Rashida Tlaib rips Biden administration's opposition to ICC war crimes probe of Israeli regime. Stay tuned for the details, please.